2. Lucian Sr., the Lucian who wrote books, often thought of how his son would turn out. Through his books, and they all, except for a forgotten novel called Fumes, were written for boys, youths, and high school students, and came in sturdy, colorful covers, there constantly flitted the image of a fair-haired lad, headstrong, brooding, who later turned into a violinist or a painter, without losing his moral beauty in the process. The barely perceptible peculiarity that distinguished his son from all those children who, in his opinion, were destined to become completely unremarkable people, given that such people exist, he interpreted as the secret stir of talent. And, bearing firmly in mind the fact that his deceased father-in-law had been a composer, albeit a somewhat arid one and susceptible in his mature years to the doubtful splendors of virtuosity, he more than once, in a pleasant dream resembling a lithograph, descended with a candle at night to the drawing room where a wunderkind, dressed in a white nightshirt that came down to his heels, would be playing on an enormous black piano. It seemed to him that everybody ought to see how exceptional his son was. It seemed to him that strangers, perhaps, could make better sense of it than he himself. The school he had selected for his son was particularly famous for the attention it paid to the so-called inner life of its pupils, and for its humaneness, thoughtfulness, and friendly insight. Tradition had it that during the early part of its existence, the teachers had played with the boys during the long recess. The physics master, looking over his shoulder, would squeeze a lump of snow into a ball. The mathematics master would get a hard little ball in the ribs as he made a run in lopta, Russian baseball. And even the headmaster himself would be there, cheering the game on with jolly ejaculations. Such games in common no longer took place, but the idyllic fame had remained. His son's classmaster was the Russian literature teacher, a good acquaintance of Lucian the writer, and incidentally not a bad lyric poet who had put out a collection of imitations of Anacreon. "Drop in," he had said on the day when Lucian first brought his son to school. "Any Thursday, around 12." Lucian dropped in. The stairs were deserted and quiet. Passing through the hall to the staff room, he heard a muffled, multivocal roar of laughter coming from class 2. In the ensuing silence, his steps rang out with a stressed sonority on the yellow parquetry of the long hall. In the staff room, at a large table covered with baize, which reminded one of examinations, the teacher sat writing a letter. Since the time of his son's entrance to the school, he had not spoken to the teacher, and now, visiting him a month later, he was full of titillating expectation, of a certain anxiety and timidity, of all those feelings he had once experienced as a youth in his university uniform when he went to see the editor of a literary review to whom he had shortly before sent his first story. And now, just as then, instead of the words of delighted amazement he had vaguely expected, as when you wake up in a strange town expecting, with your eyes still shut, an extraordinary blazing morning, instead of all those words which he himself would so willingly have provided, had it not been for the hope that nonetheless they would eventually come, he heard chilly and dull phrases that proved the teacher understood his son even less than he did. On the subject of any kind of hidden talent, not a single word was uttered. Inclining his pale, bearded face with two pink grooves on either side of the nose, from which he carefully removed his tenacious pince-nez, and rubbing his eyes with his palm, the teacher began to speak first, saying that the boy might do better than he did, that the boy seemed not to get on with his companions, that the boy did not run about much during the recess period. "The boy undoubtedly has ability," said the teacher, concluding his eye-rubbing, "but we notice a certain listlessness." At this moment, a bell was generated somewhere downstairs, and then bounded upstairs and passed unbearably shrilly throughout the whole building. After this, there were 2 or 3 seconds of the most complete silence. And suddenly, everything came to life and burst into noise. Desk lids banged and the hall filled with talking and the stamp of feet.
The long recess, said the teacher. If you like, we'll go down to the yard and you can watch the boys at play.
These descended the stone stairs swiftly, hugging the balustrade and sliding the soles of their sandals over the step rims, well polished by use. Downstairs, amid the crowded darkness of coat racks, they changed their shoes. Some of them sat on the broad window sills, grunting as they hastily tied their shoelaces. Suddenly, he caught sight of his son, who, all hunched up, was disgustedly taking his boots from a cloth bag. A hurrying tow-haired boy bumped into him, and, moving aside, Lucian suddenly caught sight of his father. The latter smiled at him, holding his tall Astrakhan shapka and implanting the necessary furrow on top with the edge of one hand. Lucian narrowed his eyes and turned away as if he had not seen his father. Squatting on the floor with his back to his father, he busied himself with his boots. Those who had already managed to change stepped over him, and after every push he hunched himself up still more as if hiding in a dark nook. When at last he went out, wearing a long gray overcoat and a little Astrakhan cap, which was constantly being tipped off by one and the same burly boy, his father was already standing at the gate at the other end of the yard and looking expectantly in his direction. Next to Lucian Sr. stood the literature teacher, and when the large gray rubber ball the boys used for soccer happened to roll up to his feet, the literature teacher, instinctively continuing that enchanting tradition, made as if he wanted to kick it, but only shifted awkwardly from foot to foot and almost lost one of his galoshes, and laughed with great good humor. The father supported him by the elbow, and Lucian Jr., grasping the opportunity, returned to the vestibule, where all was now quiet, and where the janitor, concealed by clothes racks, was heard yawning blissfully. Through the glass of the door, between the cast-iron rays of the star-shaped grill, he saw his father suddenly remove his glove, quickly take leave of the teacher, and disappear through the gate. Only then did he creep out again, and, carefully skirting the players, make his way left to where firewood was stacked under the archway. There, raising his collar, he sat down on a pile of logs. In this way, he sat through approximately 250 long intermissions, until the year that he was taken abroad. Sometimes the teacher would suddenly appear from around a corner.
"Why are you always sitting in a heap, Lucian? You should run about a bit with the other boys."
Lucian would get up from the woodpile, trying to find a point equidistant from those three of his classmates who were especially fierce at this hour, shy away from the ball propelled by someone's resounding kick, and, having reassured himself that the teacher was far off, would return to the woodpile. He had chosen this spot on the very first day, on that dark day when he had discovered such hatred and derisive curiosity around him that his eyes had automatically filled with a burning mist, and everything he looked at, out of the accursed necessity of looking at something, was subject to intricate optical metamorphoses. The page with crisscross blue lines grew blurry. The white numbers on the blackboard alternately contracted and broadened. The arithmetic teacher's voice, as if steadily receding, would get more and more hollow and incomprehensible, and his desk neighbor, an insidious brute with down on his cheeks, would say with quiet satisfaction,
"Now he's going to cry."
But Lucian never once cried, not even in the lavatory when they made a concerted effort to thrust his head into the low bowl with yellow bubbles in it.
"Gentlemen," the teacher had said at one of the first lessons, "your new comrade is the son of a writer, whom, if you haven't read him, you should proceed to read."
And in large letters he wrote on the board,
pressing so hard that the chalk was pulverized crunchingly beneath his fingers, Tony's Adventures, Silvestroff and Company, Publishers. During 2 or 3 months after that, his classmates called him Tony. With a mysterious air, the downy-cheeked brute brought the book to class, and during the lesson stealthily showed it to the others, casting significant glances at his victim, and when the lesson was over, began to read aloud from the middle, purposely mangling the words. Petrichev, who was looking over his shoulder, wanted to hold back a page, and it tore. Krebs gabbled, "My dad says he's a very second-rate writer." Gromov shouted, "Let Tony read to us aloud." "Better to give everybody a piece each," said the clown of the class with gusto, and took possession of the handsome red and gold book after a stormy struggle. Pages were scattered over the whole classroom. One of them had a picture on it, a bright-eyed schoolboy on a street corner feeding his luncheon to a scruffy dog. The following day, Luzhin found this picture neatly tacked onto the underside of his desk lid. Soon, however, they left him in peace. Only his nickname flared up from time to time, but since he stubbornly refused to answer it, that too finally died down. They stopped taking any notice of Luzhin, and did not speak to him, and even the sole quiet boy in the class, the sort there is in every class, just as there are invariably a fat boy, a strong boy, and a wit, steered clear of him, afraid of sharing his despicable condition. This same quiet boy, who 6 years later, in the beginning of World War I, received the St. George Cross for an extremely dangerous reconnaissance, and later lost an arm in the Civil War, when trying to recall, in the 20s of the present century, what Luzhin had been like in school, could not visualize him otherwise than from the rear, either sitting in front of him in class with protruding ears, or else receding to one end of the hall as far away as possible from the hubbub, or else departing for home in a sleigh cab, hands in pockets, a large piebald satchel on his back, snow falling. He tried to run ahead and look at Luzhin's face, but that special snow of oblivion, abundant and soundless snow, covered his recollection with an opaque white mist. And the former quiet boy, now a restless emigre, said as he looked at a picture in the newspaper, "Imagine, I just can't remember his face. Just can't remember." But Luzhin Sr., peering through the window around 4 o'clock, would see the approaching sleigh and his son's face like a pale spot. The boy usually came straight to his study, kissed the air as he touched his father's cheek with his, and immediately turned away. "Wait," his father would say. "Wait. Tell me how it was today. Were you called to the blackboard?" He would look greedily at his son, who turned his face away, and would want to take him by the shoulders, shake him and kiss him soundly on his pale cheek, on the eyes, and on his tender concave temple. From anemic little Luzhin, that first school winter, came a touching smell of garlic as a result of the arsenic injections prescribed by the doctor. His platinum band had been removed, but he continued to bare his teeth and curl his upper lip out of habit. He wore a gray Norfolk jacket with a strap at the back and knickerbockers with buttons below the knee. He would stand by the desk, balancing on one leg, and his father did not dare to do anything against his impenetrable sullenness. Little Luzhin would go away, trailing his satchel over the carpet. Luzhin Sr. would lean his elbow on the desk, where he was writing one of his usual stories in blue exercise books, a whim which perhaps some future biographer would appreciate, and listen to the monologue in the neighboring dining room, to his wife's voice persuading the silence to drink a cup of cocoa. A frightening silence, thought Luzhin Sr. He's not well. He has a painful inner life of some sort. Perhaps he shouldn't have been sent to school. But on the other hand, He has to get used to being with other lads. Ah, an enigma, an enigma.
Well, take some cake, then,
the voice behind the wall would continue sorrowfully, and again silence. But sometimes something horrible occurred. Suddenly, for no apparent reason at all, another voice would reply, strident and hoarse, and the door would slam as if shut by a hurricane. Then Lucian Sr. would jump up and make for the dining room, holding his pen like a dart. With trembling hands, his wife would be setting aright an overturned cup and saucer and trying to see if there were any cracks.
"I was asking him about school,"
she would say, not looking at her husband.
"He didn't want to answer, and then, like a madman."
They would both listen. The French governess had left that autumn for Paris, and now nobody knew what he did there in his room. The wallpaper there was white, and higher up was a blue band on which were drawn gray geese and ginger puppies. A goose advanced on a pup, and so on, 38 times around the entire room. An étagère supported a globe and a stuffed squirrel, bought once on Palm Sunday at the Catkin Fair. A green clockwork locomotive peeped out from beneath the flounces of an armchair. It was a nice, bright room, gay wallpaper, gay objects. There were also books. Books written by his father, with red and gold embossed bindings and a handwritten inscription on the first page, "I earnestly hope that my son will always treat animals and people the same way as Tony," and a big exclamation mark. Or, "I wrote this book thinking of your future, my son." These inscriptions inspired in him a vague feeling of shame for his father. And the books themselves were as boring as Korolenko's The Blind Musician or Goncharov's The Frigate Pallas. A large volume of Pushkin with a picture of a thick-lipped, curly-haired boy on it was never opened. On the other hand, there were two books, both given him by his aunt, with which he had fallen in love for his whole life, holding them in his memory as if under a magnifying glass, and experiencing them so intensely that 20 years later, when he read them over again, he saw only a dryish paraphrase, an abridged edition, as if they had been outdistanced by the unrepeatable, immortal image that he had retained. But it was not a thirst for distant peregrinations that forced him to follow on the heels of Phileas Fogg, nor was it a boyish inclination for mysterious adventures that drew him to that house on Baker Street, where the lanky detective with the hawk profile, having given himself an injection of cocaine, would dreamily play the violin. Only much later did he clarify in his own mind what it was that had thrilled him so about these two books. It was that exact and relentlessly unfolding pattern. Phileas, the dummy in the top hat, wending his complex, elegant way with its justifiable sacrifices, now on an elephant bought for $1 million, now on a ship of which half has to be burned for fuel. And Sherlock endowing logic with the glamour of a daydream. Sherlock composing a monograph on the ash of all known sorts of cigars, and with this ash, as with a talisman, progressing through a crystal labyrinth of possible deductions to the one radiant conclusion. The conjurer, whom his parents engaged to perform on Christmas Day, somehow managed to blend in himself briefly both Fogg and Holmes. And the strange pleasure which Lucian experienced on that day obliterated all the unpleasantness that accompanied the performance. Since requests, cautious and frequent requests, to invite your school friends never led to anything, Lucian Sr., confident that it would be both enjoyable and useful, got in touch with two acquaintances whose children attended the same school, and he also invited the children of a distant relative, two quiet, flabby little boys and a pale little girl with a thick braid of black hair. All the boys invited wore sailor suits and smelled of hair oil. Two of them little Lucian recognized with horror as Bersenyev and Rosen from class 3, who at school were always dressed sloppily and behaved violently. "Well, here we are," said Lucian Sr., joyfully holding his son by the shoulder, the shoulder slowly sliding out from under his hand. "Now I'll leave you alone. Get to know one another and play for a while, and later you'll be called. We have a surprise for you." Half an hour later, he went to call them. In the room, there was silence. The little girl was sitting in a corner and leafing through the supplement to the review Neva, the cornfield, looking for pictures. Bersenyev and Rosen were self-consciously sitting on the sofa, both very red and shiny with pomade. The flabby nephews wandered around the room examining without interest the English woodcuts on the walls, the globe, the squirrel, and a long-since-broken pedometer lying on a table. Lucian himself, also wearing a sailor suit with a whistle on a white cord on his chest, was sitting on a hard chair by the window, glowering and biting his thumbnail. But the conjurer made up for everything. And even when, on the following day, Bersenyev and Rosen, by this time again their real disgusting selves, came up to him in the school hall and bowed low, afterwards breaking into vulgar guffaws of laughter and quickly departing, arm in arm and swaying from side to side, even then this mockery was unable to break the spell. Upon his sullen request, whatever he said nowadays, his brows came painfully together, his mother brought him from the bazaar a large box painted a mahogany color and a book of tricks with a bemedaled gentleman in evening dress on the cover lifting a rabbit by its ears. Inside the box were smaller boxes with false bottoms, a wand covered with starry paper, a pack of crude cards where the picture cards were half jacks or half kings and half sheep in uniforms, a folding top hat with compartments, a rope with two wooden gadgets at the ends whose function was unclear. And there also were coquettish little envelopes containing powders for tinting water blue, red, and green. The book was much more entertaining, and Lucian had no difficulty in learning several card tricks which he spent hours showing to himself before the mirror. He found a mysterious pleasure, a vague promise of still unfathomed delights, in the crafty and accurate way a trick would come out. But still, there was something missing. He could not grasp that secret which the conjurer had evidently mastered in order to be able to pluck a ruble out of the air, or extract the seven of clubs, tacitly chosen by the audience, from the ear of an embarrassed Rosen. The complicated accessories described in the book irritated him. The secret for which he strove was simplicity, harmonious simplicity, which can amaze one far more than the most intricate magic. In the written report on his progress that was sent at Christmas, in this extremely detailed report where under the rubric of general remarks they spoke at length, pleonastically of his lethargy, apathy, sleepiness, and sluggishness, and where marks were replaced by epithets, there turned out to be one unsatisfactory in Russian language and several barely satisfactories, among other things, in mathematics. However, it was just at this time that he had become extraordinarily engrossed in a collection of problems entitled Merry Mathematics, in the fantastical misbehavior of numbers and the wayward frolics of geometric lines, in everything that the schoolbook lacked. He experienced both bliss and horror in contemplating the way an inclined line, rotating spoke-like, slid upwards along another vertical one, in an example illustrating the mysteries of parallelism. The vertical one was infinite, like all lines, and the inclined one, also infinite, sliding along it and rising ever higher as its angle decreased, was doomed to eternal motion, for it was impossible for it to slip off, and the point of their intersection, together with his soul, glided upwards along an endless path. But with the aid of a ruler, he forced them to unlock. He simply redrew them, parallel to one another, and this gave him the feeling that out there, in infinity, where he had forced the inclined line to jump off, an unthinkable catastrophe had taken place, an inexplicable miracle, and he lingered long in those heavens where earthly lines go out of their mind. For a while, he found an illusory relief in jigsaw puzzles. At first, they were simple, childish ones, consisting of large pieces cut out with rounded teeth at the edges, like petit beurre cookies, which interlocked so tenaciously that it was possible to lift whole sections of the puzzle without breaking them. But that year, there came from England the fad of jigsaw puzzles invented for adults, poozles, as they called them at the best toy shop in Petersburg, which were cut out with extraordinary ingenuity. Pieces of all shapes, from a simple disc, part of a future blue sky, to the most intricate forms, rich in corners, capes, isthmuses, cunning projections, which did not allow you to tell where they were supposed to fit, whether they were to fill up the piebald hide of a cow, already almost completed, or whether this dark border on a green background was the shadow of the crook of a shepherd whose ear and part of whose head were plainly visible on a more outspoken piece. And when a cow's haunch gradually appeared on the left, and on the right against some foliage, a hand with a shepherd's pipe, and when the empty space above became built up with heavenly blue, and the blue disc fitted smoothly into the sky, Lusion felt wonderfully stirred by the precise combinations of these very colored pieces that formed at the last moment an intelligible picture. Some of these brain twisters were very expensive and consisted of several thousand pieces. They were brought by his young aunt, a gay, tender, red-haired aunt, and he would spend hours bent over a card table in the drawing room, measuring with his eyes each projection before trying if it would fit into this or that gap, and attempting to determine by scarcely perceptible signs the essence of the picture in advance. From the next room, full of the noise of guests, his aunt would plead, "For goodness sake, don't lose any of the pieces." Sometimes his father would come in, look at the puzzle, and stretch out a hand tableward, saying, "Look, this undoubtedly goes in here." And then Lusion, without looking round, would mutter, "Rubbish, rubbish, don't interfere." And his father would cautiously apply his lips to the tufted top of his son's head and depart, past the gilded chairs, past the vast mirror, past the reproduction of Phryne taking her bath, past the piano, a large silent piano shod with thick glass and caparisoned with a brocaded cloth.